Members, we do not have quorum here, but Chair Davids needs to move quickly. He's got a lot going on today, so we're going to ask Chair Davids to introduce his bill while members are arriving. Welcome, Chair Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 3710. First of all, Mr. Chairman, I know you can't move the amendment now, but maybe we could just talk about it a second so when you do have a quorum. Basically, with the this is not just a technical author's amendment, so I'd like to describe it a little bit. In fact, maybe, I'll just go through this here. The H3710A1 amendment clarifies or puts the board in the way we would like it at this time. You can see that there's a representative of the mayor's office, city council, county board, three from, basically, we're looking at Essentia, and then we've got one from, basically, we're looking at St. Luke's, and then the other one, I thought on the board itself that we should probably look at, since there will be state money down the road if this project passes, or this bill passes, to have a member of the governor, appointed by the governor, whether he would pick a deed commissioner or assistant commissioner, something like that. So as you look at line 1.18, it'd be one member appointed by the governor who cannot be employed or filled with either business entity, so can't be somebody from basically St. Luke's or Essentia. So that's the amendment. Now, if I could please ask Ms. Dalton to kind of go over the parts of the bill that pertain to this committee, I'd really appreciate that.
Thank you, Chair Davids. Ms. Dalton, if you would.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the main parts of the bill that pertains to this committee is Section 4, which is the city powers, duties, and authority. It gives the city port authority powers, allows them to issue debt, and then I believe there's some TIF special abatement and special TIF rules under Section 5, which is the local, which is really kind of the heart of the bill. It's got special abatement rules, special tax increment financing rules, and then Section 6 basically requires the state to make support payments to the city to help finance up to $184 million of public infrastructure projects. The payments don't start until at least $360 million in public and private construction contracts have been executed. One of the changes that's also in the amendment is that of that $184 million, about $90 million of it is specified for three specific projects, and those three projects are on lines 2.9 to 2.14 of the amendment related to covering Interstate 35 and some very specific parking structures and street improvements.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Chair Davids, you testify?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And it would help if I took my A1 amendment and turned it over. There's more to it than just the board, so thank you for that, Ms. Dalton. Well, what I'd like to do, if I could, is I have a gentleman here from Essentia Health, Michael Mahoney, who is basically a resource for us here that can answer questions. And what this project does is Essentia Health is looking at some major construction and renovation, if you will, in the downtown area of Duluth. And they were trying to put a package together that would make this project more feasible so that they can basically upgrade and build their new downtown campus their new campus in downtown Duluth. So with that, I would stand for any questions on sections 4 or 5 or anything else you'd like.
Representative Davids, we do have quorum now. So Representative Barr moves that House File 3710 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Barr also moves the adoption of the H3710A1 amendment. Members, you heard about the amendment discussion or questions on it at this point? Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the H3710A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The amendment is adopted. Chair Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. So what we're looking at is...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I got to call the meeting to order. I forgot that. So, members, I call the meeting to order, and we will do that again. Representative Barr moves that House File 3710 be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Barr also moves the H3710A1 amendment. Discussion on the that amendment? Hearing none. All in favor of adopting the H3710A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The amendment is adopted.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, when your bill gets passed twice within 5 minutes, that's a good sign for the rest of the day. It really is. Okay, so with that, I would stand for questions, and I have Mr. Michael Mahoney as a resource here to help us out with any questions you'd have on Sections 4 and Sections 5. That's the we've got the TIF part here. Yeah, those are the special tax increment financing, district abatement rules, and the city may issue debt on Section 4 on page 6.
Okay. Do you want to just have Mr. Mahoney be here as a resource, or did he have a
presentation? Yeah, I think if there's questions.
Okay. Questions, members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm just trying to channel the effort we did in Rochester for Destination Medical Center, and it seemed to me that we had trigger points for some of these authorities by creating so many jobs, doing so many different things, and I'm just wondering if there's a parallel sort of set of expectations, if it does match those expectations, because I remember there's a lot of discussion about giving special authority and tying it to job creation, tying it to, other measures of success and need.
Okay, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler. Thank you so much for that question. And I have to watch myself a little bit because this has been compared to DMC in many ways, but yet if you look at the bill, it's really nothing like it. Not really. Now, as far as the trigger mechanism, if you look at page 8.21, the appropriation support payments, they're going to be looking at least, I guess, the trigger you'd call $360 million of investment, basically from Essentia. And so that comes up from them first before this gets going. And it's very tempting. A lot of folks and a lot of the press, whatever, they're calling it the DMC of the North, and they've got all sorts of names for it. I just call it a really good idea to get some improved health facilities up in Duluth, and of course you can look at the jobs part of it, the jobs aspect through the construction, and so yes, they've got to have some, if you will, skin in the game right up front here before things get moving.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought that the expectation was that the local community was going to contribute as well, since a lot of this is to deal with local infrastructure. And this seems to be more related to the expenditures by Essentia. Is that correct?
I think Ms. Dalton can help, Chair Davids, if that's okay. Chair, Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, there's three contribution points in this bill for the City of Duluth. Two of them are in Sections 7 and 8. And basically, they are extending the Duluth food and beverage tax and lodging tax for an additional 10 years to, and then the money from that will reduce the amount that the state is paying. And then there is also in the amendment, it's the very last section of the amendment, lines 215 to 228, it requires that when they build parking ramps using this money, that 50% of the net proceeds from the parking ramp revenues must also go to offset the state contribution.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, this one has kind of emerged sort of fast, it seems like, and we're still trying to catch up with what the ultimate goal is and what the long-term commitment of the state is compared to the locals, because it's, once again, just like DMC was, it may be different, but they're kind of precedents for a new state-local partnership.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, members? Okay, hearing none, Chair Davids, final thoughts?
I'd really appreciate your support. This is a very exciting project for the northeast part of our state that I think we're putting together a good plan on how to make this whole thing work, so I'd appreciate your support.
Thank you. With that, Representative Barr renews her motion. The House File 3710, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion, and members of the House File is laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you. Members, we have the minutes of the April 17th meeting. It would have been yesterday's meeting in front of us. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Representative Rarick moves adoption of the April 17 minutes. Additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the April 17, 2018 minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The minutes are adopted. Okay. Next, we have, is Representative Tice here?
Yep.
Okay, I think we'll take her bill next. Representative Tice? Representative Tice? Okay, Representative Hertas moves that House File 2010 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just discussing that 5 years ago, my son got married up in Duluth, and we had 19 inches of snow. So just hearing a couple inches is pretty good news today.
Our culture is adapting once again, Representative.
It is. First off, I have a DE1 amendment that I would like to check out first, because what it does is it just makes the language flow a lot better.
Okay.
Ms. Dalton contacted me and said that we're addressing different things, different laws, different times, and we needed to make it flow a lot better. And so with her help, well, not with her help, she absolutely did all the work. We got the amendment drafted, and now we're all on the same page.
Okay. Representative Hertas moves adoption of the H2010 DE1 amendment. Members, discussion on the amendment. It's the author's amendment. Hearing none, all in favor of the H2010 DE1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Representative Tice, the amendment's adopted.
I'm not going to take a lot of time. I'm just going to pass it right over to one of my testifiers. Matt Stalling, I think, is going to go first, unless Tony Goddard decides he did. Okay, Matt's first.
Mr. Stalling, welcome. Please introduce yourself, sir, and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee. Matthew Stalling, I'm the St. Cloud City Administrator. Thank you for allowing us to testify this morning. We're proposing a couple of increases to our local food and beverage tax by 0.5% and our hotel motel tax by 1%. Our objective here is to help to fund our municipal athletic facility, which is a regional facility. It is currently in need of some significant upgrades, and deferred maintenance needs to be addressed. It truly is a regional asset. Most of the users come from outside the St. Cloud area. That's why we're requesting these increases. One of our main partnerships at the MAC is St. Cloud State University. It's their home field for baseball. And but for the municipal athletic facility, they'd have to build their own stadium. Also, the St. Cloud Technical and Community College, it's their home field. We are also host to the Minnesota State High School League High School State Tournament. That's been a great partnership over the years. So we really feel like this is an important public asset, a regional asset. And I will pass it over to Mr. Goddard to speak more about our municipal athletic facility.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stalling. Mr. Goddard, welcome. Please introduce yourself, sir.
I am Tony Goddard. I am the Director of Community Services and Facilities for the City of St. Cloud.
Welcome.
Thank you. And I don't have a lot to add to Matt's testimony. We're certainly happy to answer any questions that you have. I would
emphasize, as he did, the partnerships that we have with state and regional institutions. So our athletic complex is an important resource for those other units of government. Both the states, we have three high schools that use our facility as their home fields. We have the College of St. Benedict, also not a public institution, but they utilize our ice arena as their home ice. And so the city is, by providing this facility, reducing the cost, the overall cost of providing athletic venues that serve the larger region in central Minnesota, and in the case of the significant number of tournaments that take place both on the baseball fields and the ice arena, we're really serving a statewide audience. Just by one illustration of the scale of this is that the baseball fields, we have two first-quality baseball fields, and more than a quarter of all the use of those fields are from the two Minnesota State institutions. So we're allowing those schools to run intercollegiate athletic programs utilizing our facility at the same rate that other renters use it.
Thank you, Mr. Goddard. Anyone else would like to testify on the bill? Hearing none, questions, members? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, the tournaments just made me think of a question. Is this what we call the Dick Putz Fields on the north part of town? Great facility and a great place to have some ball games.
Mr. Goddard.
Yes, sir, it is. We have two fields, Dick Putz Field and Joe Faber Field. And Putz is the older of the two and, frankly, needs more work. The field itself is in terrific shape, so it's a great place to play baseball, but the support facilities are pretty primitive and in need of upgrade.
Representative Anderson, any other questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, probably to the city administrator. When is the last time St. Cloud had an increase in either one of these? Because I'm from Princeton, so I know the money I spend in St. Cloud, I give to you.
Mr. Stalling.
I believe it was in 1987.
Representative Erickson?
No, thank you. I just needed that money.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, did the taxpayers weigh in on this tax increase at all?
Mr. Stalling?
Yes, this would not go into effect unless first approved by voters.
Representative Barr, anyone else? Okay, Representative Tice, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just really appreciate your support for this incredibly family-appreciated field, so thank you.
Thank you. With that, Representative Hertaus renews his motion that House File 2010 be laid over for possible inclusion, and that House File is laid over. Thank you.
Okay, next on the agenda will be House File number 4354, Mr. Anderson's, Representative Anderson's. Representative Anderson moves his House File 4354 to be entertained by the committee and held over for possible inclusion. Representative Anderson, I believe you have an amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The A1?
Yep. Would you like to move your amendment?
I'd like to move the amendment, Mr. Chair, and then I have a question also for Ms. Dalton, if I can ask her a question. Ms. Dalton, in the original bill language last year, there was also mention of a sales tax extension, and that's not in the language in this current bill. They'd also like to have that extended as well with the other extensions. So could we do that orally or add it? Does it need to be added to add the sales tax extension?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that would need an actual extra section added to the bill, and I don't have that language, so it would be hard to do it orally.
Okay.
Okay. So Representative Anderson moves his A1 amendment. Any discussion, members, on the amendment? Seeing none, the A1 amendment is adopted. To your bill, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And again, we're back again to have these numbers for you this time. And again, the City of Melrose, and with me is the Administrator of the City, Mr. Bretthorst, to talk about why the extension is needed. We're lowering the extension from 5 years down to 3 as they're working on development and need this extension to make the progress project come to fruition. Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce my testifier.
Thank you. And you have a testifier. Would you please state your name and who you represent for the record?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mike Bretthorst. I'm the City Administrator of Melrose. I've been there for a little over 7 years. I do have some prepared statements here. However, I'd just rather just
Could you spell your last name for the record?
It's spelled B as in boy, R-E-T-H-O-R-S-T.
Bretthorst.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
It's a good German name that we have there. Living in Melrose, I fit right in. So.
Yeah, das ist gut deutscher Namen.
So Melrose, we had a horrific fire, and so that's really our story and where that came from. We lost 25% of our downtown businesses and 33% of our housing stock, and so that's a significant impact to a city our size. Now, what's happened since then is we've seen some real progress. We've seen some opportunities come from this fire. We've had 2 vacant storefronts get replaced because of this for businesses that were affected by the fire with the sales tax exception. So that's helped out greatly. We currently have this coming Thursday night, tomorrow night, we have a meeting with our council and our commission to talk about an incentive package to present to a developer to build a multi-use fixed facility in our downtown to replace what was lost. You should have, I believe the gentleman is passing out some photos of it, as well as kind of the verbiage of what we've asked for. But this is an exciting opportunity to move our community forward. One of the things that came up yesterday that we found out is another reason for the need for our extension is because there's something called an EAW, an Environmental Assessment Worksheet, that's required. Because we have a river that flows right through the downtown of our Melrose community, and because of that, we have to do an EAW now, which will take up to 120 days. And there's just no physical way that we can get through the mandatory Environmental Quality Board review process and the notification process to make this a reality. We did have a developer originally. However, when he figured out what his total costs were going to be, he said it just wasn't right for him. So we had to start the process over again. And we didn't get anybody until about 4 months ago that expressed serious interest. So we're concerned that with only a 1-year extension or even a 2-year extension, if we have one hiccup, we have to start all over again. So that's why we're asking for the 3-year extension. But in conclusion here, I do want to say thank you to the Department of Public Safety, who's been helping us administer this, Wayne Wombly, Commissioner Kelly, and their team that they have there have been absolutely phenomenal helping us through this, as well as Representative Anderson, and hearing all of our stories about how things are going and one step forward and 3 steps back and moving forward again. So, but I do thank the committee here for hearing our testimony this morning and hearing our story about what's going on in Melrose and the progress that we're making. So I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bretthorst. Members, questions for the testifier or for Representative Anderson? Representative Mark.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this forward. When I come down from Dilworth, I always stop in Melrose at a convenience store and pick up some things and so forth. But I have on 2 occasions gone into the downtown and looked at things, and it was a devastating fire in Melrose and had quite an impact on various things. And I think the extension is good. You know, in these smaller communities, you know, just as the administrator was, Mr. Bretthorst was mentioning, it's a lot of stop-and-go type things. You know, people come in, take a look, you think, you know, and it's not like there's a million people coming in that you're just choosing from. And so, you know, unless things just work perfectly, you're not going to get into a time frame. It's going to take a little bit of time. So I would ask the committee to support this extension. It would be well needed, and the reasons behind it for the extension are good also. So thank you.
Thanks, Rep. Marquardt. And the last time I was in Melrose, I bought a combine in Longville and drove it all the way back to Greenfield. So I had an elevated view of the downtown.
There you go.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Anybody from the audience like to comment or testify on behalf of this bill? Seeing none with that, Representative Anderson, if you'd like to wind it up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and again, the reason stated why the extension is needed, and we'll work on this additional thing that didn't come to our attention as soon as it should have, I guess. But thank you, members, and we'll probably see you again.
Thank you, Rep. Anderson. And Representative Anderson renews his motion for House File 4354 be laid over for possible inclusion as amended. Next on the agenda will be House File 4348, Chair Drazkowski. And Chair Drazkowski moves his House File 4348 for possible inclusion. And I think, is there an amendment on that one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do also have an A1 amendment, in, which deletes Section 3 of the bill, and I would move A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? Members? Seeing none, the A1 amendment is adopted. To your bill, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, on March 11th, there were two commercial buildings in the downtown of Mazeppa that burned to the ground and are currently nothing but rubble. This bill would simply treat Mazeppa the same way that we have for other fires, Medelia, and others. And the financial impact, members, is not going to be very much. We include the sales tax exemption for construction, for reconstruction of the buildings, and the capital equipment within the buildings. So the one building was a bar and restaurant, and I believe they're rebuilding in the same fashion. The other part of the bill deals with the state refunding the city and the county for abatement of property taxes for the period of time described in the bill. And Ms. Dalton, maybe, I think that's was for fiscal year 2019 only. So we don't have those numbers yet, but you can be assured they're not going to be very big. That's the bill.
Thank you, Chair Drazkowski. Members, questions of House File 4348? Seeing none, then Chair Drazkowski renews his motion to entertain laying House File 4348 as amended to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're so welcome. Next is House File 4303. Chair Drazkowski moves his House File 4403 to be entertained and laid over for possible inclusion. And do you have an amendment on this one also?
I do, Mr. Chair. I would move adoption of the H4403A1 amendment.
All right. Any discussion on the H4403A1 amendment? Seeing none, the A1 amendment is adopted. To your bill.
Mr. Chair, I also have an A2 amendment.
Ah.
I'd move adoption of the H4403A2 amendment.
Thank you, Chair Drazkowski. Any discussion on the H4403A2 amendment?
I have one thing, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Sure.
And I didn't get a chance to review this language until this morning, and Mr. Carlson brought it to my attention yesterday during a very busy day. But I want to look at this language going forward to make sure it does what we want to do and not more. I'm concerned or not certain about the language on 1.4 where we say defendant in a county criminal proceeding, whether that would actually work against the intent of the bill or not. So, but we can look at that going forward, so I'll work with staff as we go forward on that language.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. So a little heads up, that might need a little work at the next stop. Any other discussion on the H4403A2 amendment? Seeing none, then the H44032 amendment is adopted.
I have to vote.
You have to vote on that one?
Yes.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Opposed? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, the bill as amended does two things. I do understand there's at least one county in the state of Minnesota that is setting aside a legal defense fund for people who are very likely illegal immigrants to this country who have broke federal law, which is a federal misdemeanor. What we have in this bill is language that says that if you are a county or a city in this state and you do something like this to help protect and harbor people who are breaking the law, that you will be withheld the same amount in local government aid or county program aid that you set aside to help defend or protect people who are here illegally. The amendment and the rest of the bill, Mr. Chair and members, deals with, and we heard this language last year, sanctuary cities. It says if you are a sanctuary city in this state and you are prohibiting the people in your community who work in the public sector to protect us, et cetera, if you prohibit them from asking questions about citizenship status and other characteristics, operational characteristics of a sanctuary city, that we will withhold your local government aid from you in that situation as well. So that's the bill, Mr. Chair. It's intended to encourage cities and counties to help administer the law instead of going to a point where they actually are violating the law. As we give out local government aid to cities and counties in the state, we don't want to be rewarding local jurisdictions who are breaking the law. So that's what the bill does, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Drazkowski, like the idea of this, but would a city have to officially pass an ordinance or a county? How would it be defined legally that they are doing what you think they shouldn't be doing?
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. If you look at page one of the bill, it outlines those characteristics, those operational characteristics that I mentioned earlier of a municipality which would classify them as a sanctuary city. That being said, I might want to yield to Ms. Dalton to give us a little more meat and potatoes on this one.
Thank you, Chair Drazkowski. Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, as Representative Drazkowski said, there's two ways you can be defined as a sanctuary city. The Department of Homeland Security could actually designate you as a sanctuary city, or you could have one of these ordinances or policies listed on the first page of the A1 amendment. The mayor of the city must sign and certify to the state auditor that they are not a sanctuary city. But there's nothing the state auditor has to do unless a voter in the city decides to challenge that affidavit. And it provides them the authority to challenge that in court. If the court says, nope, you really are a sanctuary city, even though you said you were not, the court then files with the state auditor that they are a sanctuary city and requires the mayor to redo the affidavit. The state auditor then every 6 months gives the Department of Revenue the list of cities that are sanctuary cities, so revenue can withhold either their first month, their first LGA payment in a calendar year or their second. So there's way the most you will ever lose on any affidavit is 6 months, but then if you don't rectify the situation, you could continue to lose.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you.
Questions from other members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm looking forward to hearing from the witnesses, but I'm wondering if staff can let us know if we have ever, on any other basis of a local decision of a city or a county, withheld their property tax relief, or if this would be a new precedent.
Chair Daskowski.
Mr. Chair, I would, one comes to mind, and that's a provision we passed into law last year that deals with local law enforcement agencies who are, Ms. Dalton, what's the word I'm looking for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, last year's provision was an aid offset to counties that were running illegal diversion programs, and if they were running illegal traffic diversion programs, which changes who gets money out of traffic stops and basically cuts out the state. And so then the county is essentially loses aid until they have repaid back the lost revenue to the state from this illegal program. There's also the requirement that we withhold aid if cities don't file all of their financial aid reports, and I believe there's one other very minor one, but I can't think what it is right now.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Dalton. Those are all failure to provide to comply with state expectations in terms of following state laws and sharing revenue from fines or complying with our accountability measures, and this one does seem to be outside of the bounds of those, and more about overseeing local decisions in other areas that the state isn't involved in. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions from members? We have a number of testifiers, Gary Carlson, Matt Hilgard, Marianne Green, Kara Lenham, and Patricia Nauman. We'll start with Mr. Carlson, League of Minnesota Cities. If you would state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm distributing a letter that, based on that past question from Representative Loeffler, does outline the penalties that are in current law.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Welcome to the committee.
Members, we respectfully oppose House File 4403, which would establish an LGA offset for certain expenditures for legal defense for immigrants, and now, as amended, would also create an aid withholding for cities that have policies that are specified in the bill or have a designation from the Department of Homeland Security. Let me say at the outset that I am not aware of any city that has in Minnesota that has a Department of Homeland Security designation at this time. And I have not done a survey of our members to see if anyone has a policy in place that would basically qualify under this bill as a reason for aid withholding. So I'm not aware of anybody that would be immediately impacted, but it doesn't mean that there would not be cities out there that would be impacted. The League of Cities supports the LGA formula. As you know, we've worked before this committee and testified before this committee that we worked hard in 2013 to revise the LGA formula to define need and capacity of cities. That formula is not perfect, as Representative Hertas has indicated, and I know we need to do some work with it. But this does establish a new penalty that is a significant deviation from the need and capacity measures that are in that current formula. As the letter indicates, until last year we had basically one penalty that applied. If you did not file your financial statements with a state auditor, there is a withholding provision, and I know we've worked with especially small cities to make sure they comply with the reporting requirement every year, and I don't think you have a bill before you this year asking for special dispensation for a city that failed to file those OSA reports. But last year we actually added two penalties. As Ms. Dalton indicated, the first penalty dealt with pretrial traffic diversion programs or illegal pretrial traffic diversion programs. And the second one was actually a small recommendation from the Minnesota Department of Revenue that we withhold aid if a city doesn't designate an official email address. This was done because the Department of Revenue wants to communicate via email with our cities, and we are in the process right now of assembling the email list for all of our cities to give to the Department of Revenue so that everyone will be in compliance with that. But again, we oppose this because it's a deviation from the current need capacity LGA measures. You may remember that last year this committee heard about three or four bills that dealt with other penalties, including World's Fair expenditures, lobbying expenditures. The only one that made it in last year was the one dealing with pretrial diversion. The League respectfully opposed all those proposals last year as well. But with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Members, questions of Mr. Carlson? Seeing none, thank you. Next, Mr. Hilgard, would you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Hilgard, and I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all Minnesota's 87 counties, and today I'm here to speak in opposition to House File 4403.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgard. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair and members, House File 4403 is a bill that would require the Commissioner of Revenue to reduce a city or county's local government aid by any amount that was spent on illegal immigration defense, a newly defined term that includes spending through grants or budget that would assist with the defense of immigrants without legal documentation. I would like to first start by thanking members of this committee for their commitment and support of County Program 8. Last year, 35 House authors, many on this committee, and many others who didn't fit on the signature list, supported revisions to the County Program Aid formula. This historic action, bipartisan in nature, had real effects on property taxes, in some cases reducing a county's levy from 9% to 1%. Even in counties where new mandates, a jail construction project, or double-digit health insurance increases kept levies from being as low as they would like, every county can say that aid reduces property tax burden. Your actions last year showed this legislator's commitment to working with your county partners and the recognition that your counties are forced to deal with many partially funded or totally unfunded mandates, which I know is not an unfamiliar story to members of this committee. I'm here to tell you that we value that commitment and we value that relationship. AMC worries that this bill would create an adversarial relationship between the state and counties by using a program traditionally used for assisting counties with unfunded and underfunded mandates to punishing counties who don't behave according to how a senator or representative may want. While I am unaware of any county aside from Hennepin County that would be impacted, it's safe to say that all counties can unite around the idea of keeping local government aid, local government aid. Setting the precedent that an entire general aid category would be contingent upon one behavior looks over the vast amount of daily work your counties and cities do on behalf of taxpayers and residents every day. Aside from eroding the trust built between state and local partners, efforts like House File 4403 could lead to a dangerous back and forth between legislators, creating winners and losers based on ideology, while hamstringing the entire purpose of LGA, which is to assist local governments with lowering levies by having dependable state aid on which to rely their budgeting process on. In closing, I do want to thank members of this committee and Chair Drazkowski for their time today, but also for your historic support and commitment to respecting your local elected governments. I know through many of the members here on this committee, their fantastic relationships with their county commissioners, and I know conversely the high esteem that local county electeds have in you. While I understand there may be conflicting views on the underlying issue of this bill, AMC respectfully asks that legislators respect locally elected officials and not tie critical state aid funding packages to individual county decisions that are made and defended at a local level. Thank you very much for your time today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgard. Questions of Mr. Hilgard from members? Okay, seeing none. Next, we'll ask Marion Green, Hennepin County Commissioner. If you would, state your name and who you represent, even though I did, for the record.
Thank you. I'm Marion Green, a member of the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I come to you today from Hennepin County, District 3, which is an urban and suburban district, an enormously diverse district by ethnicity, by race, by age, and religion. Here to share concerns that Hennepin County has with House File 4403, which sets a troubling precedent for this esteemed body to reach into the affairs of a county doing its work. For this and other reasons, I must share with you concerns that we have with this House File. With my colleagues, I've committed to our community to keep our community safe and thriving and to protect the well-being of our residents. We do so in a way that is effective and efficient and oftentimes buttress our state dollars with services funded by property tax dollars. We use property tax dollars to fund partnerships with schools, to build and maintain roads, to subsidize the cost of care at HCMC, the state's number one trauma center and largest safety net hospital. Property tax dollars help us do a lot of things to make Hennepin County and Minnesota a great place. We use some county resources to protect our residents, who are new Minnesotans, in order to keep our community safe and to protect the well-being of our residents. House File 4403 preempts Hennepin County's ability to respond to the needs of our community. Further, in this particular case, it jeopardizes our efforts to ensure that our residents receive due process and our efforts to keep families whole and safe. Let's consider Wabasha, Clay, and Pope counties as examples. Why would the legislature want to step in and tell them how to best serve their residents and how they should spend their property tax dollars? Local government is on the front lines of serving communities, and one size does not fit all 87 counties. Our democracy was founded under the principle of due process in front of the law. To keep our community safe and secure, we must respect the constitutional guarantee of due process for our residents. Whether a person should be deported is a separate issue from whether someone should have legal representation. I talked earlier about our duties as county commissioners. We also have a duty to keep families intact and protect residents from living in fear. My colleagues and I are looking at how we can better deliver services to residents, how we can best meet their needs in order for them and our economy to thrive. And we use property tax dollars to fund these programs. Hennepin County's desire to fund the best ways to serve families is not different from our peers from Kitson and Cook in the north to Rock and Fillmore in the south. We would like the legislature's support of innovation and good government, not to penalize it in the way that House File 4403 does. To conclude, I want to offer this thought. We have county government here in Minnesota because it's at that level that government can best directly serve the community. Not everyone lives in a city. Not everyone lives in a township. But everyone lives in one of Minnesota's 87 counties. County commissioners are elected to make the types of choices that will keep our communities thriving. Our residents trust us to make the right choices. Their trust should be honored by the legislature and not undermined. Mr. Chair and members, House File 4403 undermines county authority to make the right choices for county residents. It preempts our authority as local elected officials. I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I would be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Ms. Green, for your comments. A question from members, Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would respectfully disagree with your premise that this bill undermines local control. Actually, what this bill does is if a local government entity decides that they want to go down this path, that gets funded locally, that the county I'm in, who may or may not agree with what your county is doing, shouldn't have to pay for that. So we retain our local control on what our taxes are paying for. So there's a valid argument of just the opposite of what was just contended, that this bill actually does localize it, and if that revenue has to be made up with local taxpayers, those are the taxpayers who vote you in or vote you out based on the decisions you make, again, keeping all the decisions local.
Other questions, members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do think that an important distinction that Commissioner Green made was that this is just about due process. This is not about the decision of the courts will ultimately decide whether someone is here legally or not. And I have to say this right now, at this particular point in time, We are in a very confusing time because our federal government is changing its interpretations, its processes. People don't know where they stand. They don't even know if they're legal or illegal. There have been several press stories recently about people who have used what has historically, for I think over 100 years, been a route to citizenship in our country, which is if you sign up for our military and you serve in the military with and get an honorable discharge, that you are offered citizenship as a result of that. And we have depended on those people stepping up and assisting us in various times in our history. And it was always a gateway to citizenship. And now we have had people who have come back from service who have been and who have not violated any laws found that that is not being honored. And I know I've been contacted about someone, a young person who did sign up for the military, is currently in the military, expecting that at the end of his service, he will be granted citizenship if he honorably serves us, and now is afraid that he's putting his life at risk, and without that historic commitment that our country has always provided. And I think it's appropriate for our local officials to stand up and say, to that young person or other people who are now find themselves in a situation in which it is very unclear because of the changing interpretations coming out of the federal government, that they want advice on what is their rights, what arguments can be made, how fast can this go. Most of the families that we serve and that I represent, and I don't ask people their citizenship when I meet them, but they're mixed. They're mixed citizens of the United States with maybe one or two members who may have questions about whether or not their status is recognized. And we have always had a value in my community of trying to keep families together. We know when we split them apart that that increases dependency, which creates other issues for us as a state in terms of the programs that we support to try and help the families who are going through economic crisis. And so providing information so that residents of our communities can understand what their rights are, what the process is, how to move forward, is something that we do. Hennepin County has a self-service center for our legal services, which is now such a great model and has been so successful in reducing staff demand times in our court system that is being modeled across the state. Some of it is going online so that every county who has citizens who have issues that come before the courts can get information about how that process works, what their rights are, what to expect even in terms of notice and scheduling and all those sorts of things. And I think that we need to as Commissioner Green said, really look at this in terms of a county responding to its residents and their desire to have fair treatment in whatever process they're involved in, and to keep families together as much as possible.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
This is interesting, and it kind of goes beyond the scope of property taxes, but I think a lot of, or at least I have questions about what's happening, I guess, in our country. And California, for example, comes to mind. And with the Commissioner Green here, I would just ask you a simple question. Do you feel it's your duty to follow federal law? As an elected official, is it your duty to follow federal law?
Ms. Green.
I do feel it is my duty to follow federal law, and I just want to add that the money that Hennepin County is going to spend does not skirt federal law. We're not breaking federal law.
Representative Anderson. Okay, thank you. Representative Uakim.
Thank you, Chair. I guess my question is, and I do see this, of course, as you know me, I do see this as a preemption over local government, and the fact that it is kind of drafted really broadly when it talks on the amendment, line 1.5, when it says ordinance or policy, and then on 1.6, an official or employee.
Representative, you came, which amendment were you?
A1.
A1, thank you.
And if you look at that, so cities and counties are tasked with protecting the health, safety, and welfare of their citizens in many of our state statutes. And that can be anywhere from making sure when someone goes to get a permit at, that people get permits at City Hall when they build a fence so it doesn't fall over on somebody, all the way to running their own police departments, to make sure that our citizens are safe where they call home. And let's say you had a little overzealous employee who decides that when someone comes in to get a permit for a fence, that they're going to ask them about their citizenship status. Now, that doesn't seem to be necessary when applying for a permit for a fence. And let's say the city decides, no, you know, it's more important for us to people have construction permits and do what they're supposed to be doing than asking them at that time about their citizenship status. Now, maybe that same city is like, but if you're stopping them for a traffic violation or something that would lead to a gross misdemeanor, absolutely you should be asking them. Maybe that's their policy. But under this amendment, a citizen could then petition a court, a taxpayer, and say, I think my city is being a sanctuary city because they scolded that employer, told them, you know, look, we don't want you to ask about people's citizenship status when they're asking for a permit to build a fence. So I think it's kind of very broad the way we're going to end up defining what sanctuary cities are, and I think we should be careful for that. And as some of the other testifiers said, local government aid is a property tax relief program. It's not to be used as a stick to beat our cities into submission or the counties. So, you know, I'm really concerned about where this is, what path this is leading us down. So I guess that's more of a statement than a question. Thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a bit of a follow-up on Representative Anderson's question just about following federal law, and I appreciate your testimony, but just in reading the amendment, the way I read this, that a sanctuary city means a home rule city, charter city that adopts an ordinance or policy that in any way would prohibit or restrict, and if you jump to line 1.8, lawfully cooperating with or aiding federal officials or employees, it would suggest to me that if you were restricting or prohibiting lawful cooperation with the federal government, you're aiding and then breaking the laws of the federal government. So how would you rectify those two things?
So what Hennepin
Ms. Green.
Thank you. I beg your pardon, Mr. Chair. What Hennepin County has introduced is an immigration legal defense fund, and the idea is to help.
Could you please speak into the microphone?
Oh, sorry.
Thank you.
What Hennepin County has introduced is an immigration legal defense fund, and the idea is to provide legal representation for people who are sucked into deportation proceedings who have documentation that they haven't mailed in or reason to be here. And this does not take on, it doesn't take on their criminal case, and it also doesn't make any statement as to whether or not employees should or should not be asking about immigration status. So we're not, this is just all about representation and not at all about saying what employees should or shouldn't do that does or does not comply with federal law.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the policy wouldn't restrict or prohibit cooperating with federal law, then what specifically, what part of the bill or amendment are you opposing? I'm a little confused.
Ms. Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm here to oppose is the state government withholding legal aid, or I'm sorry, local government aid, county aid, because of a policy decision that Hennepin County has made to do with our property tax dollars.
I guess it is called LGA. We could call it legal government aid, right? All right. Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I think, just in general, my understanding of this, I think, is maybe too simplistic, but as a state, we want to ensure we're following the laws of the federal government. We want to ensure that we have a good working relationship with the federal government. So I think it's in our best interest to ensure that our local governments are following federal law. To me, the way that I read this, if you're following the law, you have nothing to worry about. So maybe that's too simplistic of a summary, but I guess I'm happy to have more information provided or follow up. I think there's just a
I'm hoping we can find some agreement on this, because absolutely we want to do everything we can to help folks that are in need of help. You know, we want to work with the federal government. We don't want to, I don't want to butt heads with the federal government, but as was said earlier, this really is an issue that the federal government hasn't addressed. And so they're trying to address it. You know, if they send folks here, federal officials are here in our state trying to address this issue, we should be working with them and encouraging that.
Thank you, Representative Whalen. And members, we have other folks that want to testify. I'm going to take one more question, Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just following up on this line of questioning, I mean, all the comments that have been made so far have been to the certain definitions and process and procedures, and very little and with regards to the conversation that should be before us, which is the conversation around what to do with the local government aid and whether or not that local counties and cities should be penalized based on those behaviors. It just seems to me that this is more appropriately be vetted before a committee like civil law or even public safety. Has there been consideration in sending this to other committees? I guess it's a question for the author.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Carlson. Yeah, actually, this language, the amendment language was heard before the Government Operations Committee last session. And it was laid over in the committee.
Representative Carlson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Draskowski, that was the A1 amendment or the entire what were you referring to there, sir?
Mr. Chair. Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson, that's correct. A1 amendment.
The A1. Okay.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Draskowski, the A2 then, which you specified that there was some inconsistency, especially in line 1.4, that you would be giving some further consideration based, I mean, this is pretty significant. It's only a few lines, but would this then be going back to that committee for their review?
Chair Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson, this language or the intent behind it was brought to me by Mr. Carlson from MICA yesterday, and so it's an intent to create an exception. We can have maybe Mr. Carlson talk about that when he comes up. I think that might be helpful for the committee.
I would agree. And
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does appear significant and would have some major implications. And again, not having directly dealing with the LGA discussion that we're supposed to be having in this committee. So I would also encourage the consideration that this be brought to civil law as well. There's a lot of legalese and definition in here that I think is very impactful in terms of how a bill such as this may be implemented. So for that level of clarification and have some of our attorney members weigh in on this in a committee setting, I think would be fruitful. Thank you.
Chair Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The underlying bill, Representative Carlson, I mean, we're basically talking about local government aid here, and that's what we're talking about. I could probably agree with you on the sanctuary city piece, which is the A1 amendment, and it was heard before the local or the government ops committee last session. So that has gone to other committees. Has it gone to civil law? And maybe we can have that argument. Anyway, look forward to discussion as we go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Draskowski. I would guess I would just disagree with the fact that the conversation hasn't been about LGA. It has been more about the implications and the rollout of a bill like this in terms of the procedural aspects of it, in terms of definition and so forth, that has dominated the whole conversation up until this point. So I think it's a little disingenuous to say the conversation has been about LGA when, as far as I've been sitting here, it's been about the complete opposite. So thank you.
So thank you, Mr.
Sherpa.
Chair Draskowski.
Yeah, and Representative Carlson, I think certainly the intent behind the bill is about LGA. The question is, should we be giving LGA and CPA to communities that are breaking the law? And that's a policy question we're looking at. Or are purposefully averting federal law? And that's what it's about. I mean, certainly the passion behind the members of the committee has been getting into maybe the weeds that you're talking about, but the bill doesn't say for Hennepin County, for instance, you can't have a legal defense fund. If Hennepin County wants to have a legal defense fund, it doesn't do anything to prohibit them from it. It just says, we're not going to use state taxpayer money to fund it. Because indirectly, that's what's going on, is we're taking LGA and sending it to the local government unit, and we're paying for that. And it's making a policy decision or policy discussion around what should we be using the LGA and CPA pot for. Should we be giving it to communities who are either breaking the law or averting federal law? And that's the question, and the policy that I'm proposing behind it is no. It says if you want to do that, if you want to become a sanctuary city and have policies and tell your employees that you can't ask immigration status or whatever you want to do, go ahead and do it. But the citizens of Steele County are not going to be forced to pay for Hennepin County's decision to do so or any other county or city in the state. So that's the impetus behind the bill, and that's where my discussion is on it, but certainly other members may be talking about things that are more in the weeds than that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I did say Representative Carlson is going to be the last person on this testifier, but Representative Loeffler wants to respond to Representative Whalen's comments. So, Representative Loeffler, you will have the last word on this testifier.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out that there's two different, very, very different sort of targets in this bill. One was the one that you were referring to, Representative Whalen, which was added with the A1 amendment related to sanctuary cities. The county issue related to assisting people with understanding their legal rights is actually in the bill as it was introduced, and it begins on the first page and continues on to the section, and it is about providing legal services to illegal immigrants, and they haven't been determined to be illegal at that point, so I think the wording is wrong, but to immigrants in preparing defense against deportation from the United States of America. And so this is about the county providing legal information about how our legal service works, you know, how to interact with our courts, to people who have not been found to be illegal at that point. It's like when we jail people, we arrest people, we charge them, they have legal rights to understand the process that they're going through. And then it is the courts that makes the decision about whether or not that person is guilty. And so this is asking us to withhold state funding for something that counties have traditionally done for every person who is charged with a crime, who is arrested, some of whom are put into jail for public safety reasons or because that's the expectation. And they all have, under our Constitution, the right to be considered innocent until proven guilty and to be given information about the processes that they are exposed to. And I think this is really going against our U.S. Constitution's expectation of assuming people are innocent until proven guilty and that they have the right to understand their rights under the law. And their rights under the law, quite honestly, I still think are very, very confusing. DACA students who were under the last federal administration were given rights to have jobs for employers to hire them are now in a state of limbo, and they were promised it would be resolved by a certain date, and it wasn't, and it's still pending at the federal level. The employers want to know what can I do or not do, and so this is just about information about the process.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And with that, we'll move on to the next testifier, Ms. Linum. Welcome to the committee, and if you'd state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Hi, my name is Carol Linum, and I represent the Minnesota Dakotas chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association.
Thank you, Ms. Linum, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me. So again, my name is Carol Linum, and I'm an immigration attorney in private practice here in St. Paul, and I'm here today to testify in opposition to HF 4403. The American Immigration Lawyers Association is a professional organization. Our local chapter includes immigration attorneys in Minnesota and the Dakotas who represent immigrants, including in front of our immigration courts. I just want to start off by saying that being in the United States without status is not a crime. There's nothing illegal about being here without documents or having overstayed a visa or anything like that. I think it's important to note that all kinds of immigrants end up in front of an immigration judge facing deportation proceedings. Many immigrants facing deportation are encountered by immigration after being involved in a minor traffic matter or being pulled over for a very simple minor traffic violation, including possibly even being an innocent party in a car accident. In 2017, over 1,100 immigrants in Minnesota without any criminal record at all were picked up by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. There is no triaging or prioritizing of immigration cases anymore before our judges. Anyone encountered by ICE is considered a candidate for deportation, including people who have been here for dozens of years and have U.S. citizen family. It's important to remember, too, that deportation proceedings or removal proceedings, as they're called under the legal terms, those are civil matters, and you're entitled to counsel in front of an immigration judge. You have a right to counsel. There are no public defenders, and there are no free attorneys for this. We are fortunate in Minnesota to have the Minnesota Detention Project, which does provide free legal services to someone's first detained hearing, which contributes to judicial efficiency by giving people access to information and rights and helps hearings move along faster, and, of course, provides information to families and the detained immigrant about their rights. But being in immigration court does not mean you're going to be deported. There are all kinds of pathways to stay in the United States, even if you're in front of a judge. And our job as attorneys is to make sure that people know about those. I could spend all day talking about that, but that could be applying for asylum, applying for Convention Against Torture. These are treaty obligations the United States has that need to be taken seriously, and immigrants have a right to apply for those things, and they have a right to a lawyer when they do so. They can also apply for a green card in front of a judge. Again, there's all kinds of pathways. Being in front of an immigration judge does not mean you're going to be deported. The statistics show that if you have an attorney and you apply for one of these pathways to relief, 60% of those people that have an attorney in trial for this win their cases. Only 17% win if they don't have a lawyer. And they're also more likely to appear for their hearings. They're more likely to ask for this relief. For our purposes here in Minnesota, we want people to apply for this. We want to keep people in our communities. Over 50,000 U.S. citizen children live with someone who's undocumented. If their parents or their family members are removed or deported from the United States, what happens to those U.S. citizen kids? They're our friends, our neighbors. Those are important people in our communities. We don't want them ending up in foster care. We don't want them, we don't want them losing their economic stability. In addition to, we don't want our family and friends to actually be deported. I also wanted to speak briefly to the sanctuary amendment that was added this morning.
And if you could, and conclude as soon as possible. Thank you.
Can do. Well, lawyers are very verbose. I apologize. There is no federal definition of sanctuary city, and there's significant litigation going on at the federal level about sanctuary policies. So I just want to note that I think Minnesota should be mindful of that if they move forward with this, because that is a contentious issue that is subject to serious federal litigation at this point. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Lynam, and thank you for some of those comments. I think we heard some things we weren't familiar with. Representative Yua Kim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Lynam, for your testimony. Listening to you makes me even more concerned about the language in the underlying bill on 2.3 to 2.6 that defines a legal immigrant in our state statutes. Could you tell me, giving your legal opinion on that language, if that would actually get us in trouble with the courts?
Ms. Lynam.
And so you said 2.3 to 2.6, correct? I mean, I have a lot of problems with the way this was written. First thing, the phrase foreigner is not even defined in our Immigration and Nationality Act. It's unclear, is a lawful permanent resident included in this? It's very broadly written, and it doesn't include terms that are actually defined in immigration law. So this would be going outside of existing immigration law and creating new definitions that wouldn't be able to link back to anything else.
Okay. Representative Yuakim? Okay, thank you. Question? Representative Anderson, and then Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, ma'am, for your testimony. And you said that it's not illegal to be in this country without documentation, and I take you at your word for that. But my question is, how do you get into the country without documentation? Representative, I'm sorry, Ms. Lanham.
Oh, thank you. That's a great question. So, yeah, so that's a distinction. So when we talk about that federal misdemeanor, that is the illegal entry, this federal misdemeanor. That is the only federal misdemeanor that applies in this. Immigration is otherwise entirely civil. So if someone were to cross what we call entered without inspection, crossing at some non-traditional border point, anything, that could be any, our border is so diverse. But once you're in, once you've crossed over, you're not breaking a law at that point. Once you're in, there is no federal law saying you are illegal. It is just the act of entering without permission. At that moment, that's a federal misdemeanor. But if you're walking, or you're driving down 94 in Minnesota and you overstayed your visa or you entered without inspection, that there is no federal law being broken at that moment.
Yeah, Representative Anderson. Well, thanks again, Mr. Chair. And I'm a little bit confused. So you're saying that the act of walking across the border is illegal, but once you're across the border, it's no longer illegal? That's kind of wiped off the slate? I don't get that.
Ms. Lanham.
Unfortunately, I didn't write those laws. Our Congress did in D.C., but yes, that is correct. That is how they wrote the law.
Representative Vaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll read 8 U.S. Code Section 1325. Improper time or place, avoidance of examination or inspection, misrepresentation, concealment of facts. Any alien who enters or attempts to enter the United States at any time or place other than as it's designated by immigration officers or eludes examination or inspection by immigration officers or attempts to enter or obtain entry to the United States by willfully false or misleading representation or willful concealment of a material fact shall, for the first commission of any such offense, be fined under Title 18 or imprisoned not more than 6 months, or both for a subsequent commission of such offense be fined under Title 18 or imprisoned not more than 2 years or both. That's I'm not a federal immigration attorney, but that's what the federal law says.
So it would appear then if you paddled across in a canoe from Canada into the boundary waters of Minnesota, that's not a legal point of entry and you'd be violating the law. You're supposed to go straight to the paddle straight to the checkpoint. Is that what you're supposed to do?
Yeah, well, so I am a federal immigration attorney. Yes, so you're supposed to go to a border checkpoint. Our northern border has all kinds of interesting issues, including the one with Alaska. But what you're referring to is the time of entry. That is the same thing. That is, as you enter, you are required to go to a CBP. Sometimes it's a CBP telephone, quite honestly, up on the northern border, but other times it is a very formal border crossing point. So if you evade that, that is the point where you'd be violating that federal law that you quoted. But like I said, once you're in and once you're here, that's now a civil matter for our deportation and removal courts to deal with.
Thank you. Representative Barr, you'll be the last comment with this testifier, and we'll move on to the next one.
Thank you. I have two questions, Mr. Chair. One is, I'll just preface it by saying I think we can all agree that we don't want vulnerable people not to have representation and that kind of support. I think the question for me is we're talking about local government aid, and specifically here we're talking about property tax relief. And so you had mentioned earlier, I might not have the exact name, but the Minnesota Defense Project.
Minnesota Detention Project.
Detention, I'm sorry, I wrote Defense Project. So the Minnesota Detention Project, is that funded with local government aid, or how is that funded and supported?
Ms. Lanham.
Thank you. That is entirely volunteer and pro bono run by local nonprofits and pro bono attorneys like myself and local law school clinics.
Representative Barr.
Just to follow up on that, so as I'm sitting here and listening to all of this, I've been wondering to myself, is there a different way to fund some of that support of folks who are being pulled into the courts? And I know I'm not an attorney, but I understand there's a lot of pro bono work and things, and I'm just wondering that maybe it could be better handled in a nonprofit environment with the support of volunteers and people like that and take it out of local government aid conversation. So that's just a comment on that. And then since we are here talking about local government aid and property tax, I'm not sure who to direct this question to. It might have been our prior testifier, but I'm just wondering, for Hennepin County, are property taxes going up or down, since we're talking about how local government aid is used, and we are here talking about property tax and the bills we're passing, we're trying to provide relief to property tax owners. So I don't know who could comment to that.
Ms. Lanham?
As a proud Ramsey County resident, unfortunately, I can't speak to that.
Representative Barr, the levy for Hennepin County last year was 4.1%, I recall, increase. This year it's being proposed. I think I recall a commissioner visiting my office and stating that it was proposed to be 3.9% increase this year. So generally it's been on the rise. We'll call the next testifier, Ms. Patricia Nauman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lynam, for your testimony. If you would state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. My name is Patricia Nauman. I represent the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, or Metro Cities.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Metro Cities would strongly but respectfully oppose the bill, House File 4403, that is before you today. The organization's policies generally oppose a withholding, reduction, or any offsets in local government aid that are not formula-based. So the organization does have support having the LGA be distributed on a formula-based level. We do oppose having aids be offset due to any particular activities or decisions that are made at the local level. That is a general policy of the organization, as it compromises potentially the intent of the local government aid program to provide aid and being, again, distributed on a need-based formula and a capacity-based formula. I also want to speak today. The Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities was not able to be here, but they did ask Gary Carlson or I to share with you their opposition to House File 4403 as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Questions for Ms. Nauman? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Nauman, for testifying. Are there any other persons from the community that would like to testify? Let's see. We've got one, two. Raise your hands, please. One, two, three, four, five. Okay, let's start with the gentleman right here. If you would please come, and we'll try to wrap this up because we'll probably want to take some questions. Please limit your comments to about 2 minutes. Go ahead and introduce yourself and who you may represent for the record.
Yes, my name is the Reverend Dr. Rye Sigelko. I'm a pastor locally here in Minneapolis at Faith Mennonite Church. I'm also a professor of theology at the University of St. Thomas and at Bethel University, so I'm a part of a number of different organizations. I'm also a board member of an organization called Assemblea de Derechos Civiles, which is an advocacy organization that helps to support our immigrant brothers and sisters.
So which hat are you wearing today, or is it a big one?
It's a big one.
Okay.
But I think primarily I wear the hat of a father, and I wear the hat of a husband, and I wear the hat of a community member and a friend.
Thank you, sir. Please proceed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm here to oppose this bill, 4403, very, very strongly. I'm doing it in part because of my relationship to my own children, and to my spouse, who herself is an immigrant to this country. And I would like to ask all of you in this room, including people in the audience, to consider your own immigration status for a moment. Just take a moment to think about your own immigration status. How did you come here? How did you find yourself in this place at this time? Were you born here? Did you just find yourself perhaps here? Yes, maybe. Some of you. Maybe you will look back to your parents. Did they find themselves here? Maybe. Maybe you look back to your grandparents, right? Each of us has a path, right, that have brought us here. Unless you're indigenous to this land, you came here, most likely, as an immigrant, right? Whether documented or undocumented, whether welcomed or not. I want you to consider this, that immigration is a human reality, that people move to and fro for a number of different reasons. This bill, it seems to me, attempts to put obstacles in the way of legal defense to people who are already under great threat in this country, who already face financial insecurity. In this way, it is deeply immoral, I believe it is undemocratic. And perhaps, as a minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ, I believe it is anti-Christ.
30 seconds, sir.
I believe, in fact, it is demonic. I want you to take that very seriously, if you are a person of faith. Even if you do not believe that you are charged as a representative to protect or to represent immigrants in this country who are undocumented, you do have a responsibility as a human being to respect them as human beings. They are not criminals. They are people of God. The last thing that I want to say is just an experience I had with my daughter the other night. We were out for pizza, and I asked them, because their mother is an immigrant, I said, how would it feel if ICE, Immigration Customs and Enforcement, came to our house and knocked on the door and took away your mother? How would that make you feel? And my 8-year-old looked at me and said, I would not like that. Well, most of your friends, honey, I had to tell her this. I had to tell my daughter this. Most of your friends, they face this question every day. My daughter goes to a Spanish immersion school. Many of the people in her community are undocumented. Their parents are undocumented. I will not allow for this to happen, for my child's friends' parents to be torn away from them.
Thank you for your testimony. We're going to take the next testifier. And members, we're going to hold questions because I know a lot of people want to speak on this. We'll hold questions till the end. Thank you, and there may be a question for you. Please state your name and who you may represent for the record, please.
Good morning to all. My name is Luz Maria Lopez Rosas, and I'm representing myself.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I want to first and foremost reclaim my community's humanity. I hear that you've all been saying illegal immigrants. And they're not illegal because human beings cannot be illegal. They're still people. And I'm in tears because 11 years ago, 10 minutes away from here, at 732 Randolph Avenue, my mother was picked up by ICE. Thank you. They came into my home and they started pulling my mother away like she was a criminal. And it breaks my heart to hear that you are attempting to put us as second-class citizens like you did with slaves, because we have rights. And whether you like it or not, the truth is that we too pay taxes, so we have a say in how these taxes are used. They take them out of our paychecks, and we have ITIN numbers. We pay. We pay in this country, and we contribute millions of dollars here. I don't want to hear that this is only for citizens, because it's not. And I'm sorry that I'm in tears, but it breaks my heart because the political situation is so tense and stressful for our communities. This happened to me 11 years ago, and unfortunately, in one day in Tennessee, it happened to 500 children. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you about all the woes that came after that, but I want you to touch your hearts and think about, when you're talking about these kinds of things, you're talking about people. You're talking about affecting real life people. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Again, if you would state your name and who you represent for the record, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Caroline Palmer. I'm from the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I represent our Public and Legal Affairs Division. And I just wanted to make a couple of brief comments. I know so many people on this committee care about crime victims and public safety. I see it even here in one of the amendments, which addresses victims. We are always concerned when there's any sort of barrier to justice for crime victims. We know that often, victims of crime who are in our immigrant communities understand the risk of coming forward to report what happened to them. They may not come forward when they recognize that their families could be torn apart, that they could be harmed. Sometimes they're even afraid to come forward because of who the perpetrator is. It has so many ripple effects.
And so what I wanted to kind of point out, you know, what happened in cities and counties around the country is law enforcement really wants to make a close engagement with immigrant communities in order to know who the victims are and also to know who the perpetrators are. This is a very, very important public safety issue for victims of sexual assault and all crime victims in general. And so we hope that as you're considering this legislation that you think about the impact that comes when crime victims believe that the system isn't ready to hear them and that there are consequences for them coming forward. That affects all of us, regardless of what our immigration status is in our communities. So thank you for the time, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer. Next testifier. Again, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Lars Negstedt. I'm the policy director for ISAIAH. I'm disappointed to be here this morning. I've testified before in front of this committee last year on a similar measure, and I won't repeat that, just to state that the Bible could hardly be more clear. We are to welcome the stranger, welcome the foreigner, the alien, the immigrant, as we have all been in that position at some point in our past. In the Gospel of Matthew chapter 25, Jesus says, as you have done for the least of these, you have done for me. One of the things that has been missing largely this morning is the experience of people facing immigration court. And so I would like to submit for the record two stories that I've written up from visits to immigration court here at Fort Snelling that I would hope you would each read in detail. Very briefly, one was a man who came in 1991 as a boy, as a seven-year-old boy, later had issues with addiction and alcohol abuse, got caught up with some drug possession, was appearing in court via video from prison, from state prison, serving a five-year sentence on a drug possession charge. He has two teenage children that rely on him for emotional and material support. They were in court testifying. This is a man who has not been in his home country since the age of seven, has no property in his home country, has no close relatives in his home country, no knowledge of that country. He's serving his time for his crime here in state prison. Having cleaned up, he became an alcohol Al-Anon sponsor and a mentor to others in his community, and yet he's facing the possibility of deportation to a country he doesn't even know. And I would ask the question of whether justice is served by that, and what are the costs to our community of sending somebody like that back. Luckily, that man did have an immigration attorney to help him navigate the process. The second story is a young woman who was a mother of three children, two of whom are U.S. citizens, who was fearing for her life if she were deported and was seeking asylum. She was facing immigration court without an attorney and was being questioned directly by the judge because she could not be examined by her own attorney. It was heartbreaking to see her struggle to communicate her story. She did very well through the interpreter communicating her situation, yet she could not prove, and she didn't know the ins and outs of seeking asylum. She had to prove that the threat that she feared had some governmental connection. There was very narrow legal grounds for her to get asylum case. And even though the judge in the end ruled that he found her story credible, he said he did not have the legal standing to grant her asylum here in this country. So she was removed from the country for this. And potentially, who knows, her life might be in danger. She's the mother of three children, including two U.S. citizens. So these stories are written up, and I'd like to submit them for the record, and I hope you will pay close attention, and I hope you will oppose this measure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Anybody else would like to testify? Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Keller. I'm the Executive Director of the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota. We are a statewide organization that provides legal services, education, and policy services across the state. We have five offices, two in the metro and three in greater Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Keller.
Thank you. I want to be as brief as I can. This is an extremely complex bill that's been introduced and the ideas in it, I do agree, should also be vetted and heard in the Civil Law Committee because of the complexity, some of which were pointed out by my colleague, Ms. Lynham, that I think will cause more confusion because they are not aligned with terminology under the federal law. I also want to try to clarify a little bit of what I think is some misunderstanding by some of the committee about whether or not following federal law is really in question under the base bill, 4403. The idea that persons facing deportation have a right to counsel can't be any clearer than in the Immigration and Naturalization Act code. In the code, it says any person facing removal or deportation has a right to counsel. And I think the easiest way it's, we understand and deal every day with people who don't work in immigration law with just how complex this area is. And these are English speakers, people who've lived in the United States. I would submit persons like yourself who don't have any reason to know about immigration law. The complexity for somebody whose language, first language is not English, to encounter and defend themselves in deportation is at least 10 times more complex. The importance, we see it every day in the work that we do in representing individuals in front of the immigration court, is sometimes a matter of life and death. Let me give you some examples of people and circumstances that the federal law says should be considered if they find themselves in deportation as defenses. As another testifier testified, persons who are undocumented or who have lost their status and who are victims of serious crime in the United States have a right to apply for something called a U visa. The U visa was passed with the Violence Against Women Act and has been a part of our federal immigration code for at least 25 years. The purpose of the U visa impacts the county, impacts the family, and the overall goal of it is to encourage crime victims. This is usually women and children who've been victims of violence in the home or victims of sexual abuse, to trust local law enforcement. Why is it important for them to trust local law enforcement? Because someone who commits that crime against perhaps an undocumented person today also may commit it against a citizen or a legal permanent resident tomorrow. The overarching goal, and here we're talking about complex, multiple jurisdictions, is to stop crime. The U visa system is a functioning system. What we have seen since the beginning of this administration is crime victims across the country who refuse to contact local law enforcement for fear that that contact with local law enforcement will turn them into ICE.
Excuse me, Mr. Keller, I want to allow a little bit of time for some questions of members, yeah. So if you could conclude. Thank you.
So the U visa and the perception that counties that value the ability to defend yourself with laws, with federal deportation laws that our Congress has approved, is somehow not following the law could not be further from the truth. The second example I would render in terms of people that we see who succeed and who prevail are persons who fear for their life. We have, as previously mentioned, asylum laws, protection against people who would be subjected to torture, and those cases are won every day before our immigration judge. And lastly, permanent residents. So persons who have a green card, who've obtained it either through refugee or asylum status, or who have gotten it through marriage or through employment, also face deportation if they run afoul, even with misdemeanors. Those folks, some have gone as far as the U.S. Supreme Court to prove that there's an obligation by public defenders to let them know whether or not a crime they plead guilty to could lead them into deportation. So these are matters of extreme high importance with multiple levels of jurisdiction that have already weighed in on them. And I really caution the committee to jump into an area of law without it being fully vetted.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. And is there anyone else that would like to testify from the audience? One more. You'll be the last, sir. Strictly 2 minutes. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Gene Ranieri. I represent the City of Minneapolis. I'm the Director of Intergovernmental Relations. In looking at the bill, I was trying to figure out, are we a sanctuary city or not? And reading through it, there are about six different items, that, and I think you have to qualify for all six. For sure, we are not on the list of Homeland Security, nor are we on the list for Department of Justice. I think the issue for us is maybe one issue would make us possibly a sanctuary city, and that's inquiring about a person's citizenship or immigration status. We have what is called a separation ordinance, where we will enforce our law, state law, but we expect ICE to enforce the immigration laws. However, we work with ICE and with other folks when it comes to crimes. If there is an investigation that involves a person who may have immigration status and our police need to be involved, we do cooperate and work with Homeland Security. In fact, at the end of our ordinance, we have a statement that says, nothing in this chapter shall prohibit public safety personnel, that's police, fire, and our city attorneys, from assisting federal law enforcement officers in the investigation of criminal activity involving individuals present in the United States who may be in violation of federal civil immigration laws. So we don't think we're violating any law, but under this proposal, we probably would be losing our aid.
Okay, thank you with that. And Representative Whalen had a question. Looks like she removed herself. Uakim, Representative Uakim has a message.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe piggybacking on what Mr. Ranieri just said on the A1 amendment and the definitions of sanctuary cities, you had mentioned, Mr. Ranieri, you thought maybe in the reading of the language that a city had to be all six. I'm concerned, and maybe council can direct me, on line 1.12, with the word or at the end, does that mean you could just have one of these and you don't have to have all six of these?
Ms. Galton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that would be the way the law reads to me as well.
Representative Uakim.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. And Mr. Chair, there's just so many things wrong with this bill. I don't even know where to start, and I don't want to keep us any longer. But we've had some really compelling testimony, and I really do hope that people take that into strong consideration. It really is a balancing act for our cities to make sure that they do the public health safety and welfare of their citizens. And even if you just look at the public safety aspect with our officers, you're putting them in a very bad position with this bill and them being able to do their job and making sure that citizens feel like they can come to them if they've been victims of crimes. And I know, having served on the city council for 9 years, our police departments take that really seriously. So if anything, bottom line is, please don't make their jobs harder, and then also take into consideration all the compelling testimony we've had here today.
Thank you, Representative Uakim. And members of the audience, just remember that the motion before us is to lay this over for possible inclusion. We'll take one more question, and then we're going to be out of time. Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Juskowski, for bringing the bill. And I just wanted to just comment real briefly on the matters of faith that were brought up, because I think it's important to recognize that a lot of us share the same faith, and it's challenging to hear sometimes that if you believe this or that about a bill, that you may or may not have a stronger faith. Jesus said to care for the orphans and the widows, and it also says in the word, you know, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. That's in Romans 13. So you can't pick and choose parts of Scripture. You have to take it as a whole. Just wanted to put that out there, and I'm happy to have conversations with anyone on this. I think it's an important issue. I think the bill intent of is good. I also think obviously, it can be very emotional, and so we want to make sure we're showing compassion and understanding to one another, even if we end up disagreeing at the end of the day. So,
thank you, Representative. And Representative Draskowski, if you would like to make concluding remarks, we can finish right on time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the discussion. This bill really is intended to have policy that doesn't reward cities and counties that either violate federal law or that avert the enforcement of federal law. And the idea is that some citizens in the state that are in jurisdictions where they are following federal law shouldn't be compelled to pay through local government aid or county program aid for communities to violate federal law. So that's the intent of the bill, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the discussion, and look forward to more down the road.
Thank you, and thank you, everybody in the audience. It has been a vigorous discussion. With that, Representative Drazkowski renews his motion to lay over House File 4403 as amended. Members, just an announcement. We're going to have a Friday hearing to go over the division report, and I'm instructed that it is going to be approximately 10 a.m., but watch your email box as to when it will happen exactly. So with that, members, we are adjourned.